couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films, The Secret Life of Pets 2, Dark Phoenix, All is True, and The Souvenir. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring a look at Captain Marvel and the Entity new to Blu-ray. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Apparently, DC, which is a part of Warner, is starting their own, basically, DC Heroes streaming TV show. Because if you look at the DC properties, stuff like Superman, Batman, and all those ancillary things, where they actually have the most success is on their episodic television series. I mean, Smallville ran for, 10 seasons, and then they had Gotham, and they've had Arrow, and they've had The Flash, and all of those series tend to do really, really well and get an audience, and they captivate, a certain demographic. When they do the movies, it's kind of hit or miss. I mean, you've had movies make money just because Batman versus Superman made a lot of money, and I kind of thought that one was okay. Does not mean that it was considered a hit. It left a lot of people with a sour taste in their mouth. Same thing with Suicide Squad. Suicide Squad was a big moneymaker, but it's not considered a good movie. It's not remembered very fondly, which is why they're essentially rebooting it as The Suicide Squad with James Gunn at the helm. So while the movies have done well, stuff like Wonder Woman and Aquaman, some of them have been middling or haven't been getting the returns that they wanted, something like what happened with Man of Steel. Even though that was considered a hit, it still wasn't, it wasn't The Dark Knight. It reminds me of a similar thing that happened when Sony had complete control of some of the Marvel stuff when they were trying to reboot The Amazing Spider-Man in 2012 and 2014. They were expecting the numbers that they got initially with the Spider-Man movies that Sam Raimi did. But these ones that had Andrew Garfield as the Spider-Man, it just wasn't as big. And part of what's happened here, and this goes to something I'm going to talk about with Dark Phoenix, is superhero movies have sort of transcended the original run. You know, back in the early 2000s, you had the 1-2 punch of X-Men and Spider-Man. And those were huge movies. You kind of go back and you watch those original movies and they're a little corny now. They don't quite work. And I remember saying about Venom last year that Venom felt like an early 2000s kind of movie. It didn't feel like it lived into the evolution that the Avengers, the cinematic universe of Marvel has taken the stories, or even where Christopher Nolan took The Dark Knight. And even Christopher Nolan couldn't live up to The Dark Knight with The Dark Knight Rises. So they started this streaming service for basically television, and one of the big shows that they're going to do was Swamp Thing, which is a great comic from years ago. And, you know, Wes Craven had done a movie back in the 80s, and it's a little corny. But so they shot the first season, and they, instead of dropping the whole series, sometimes binge-watching, they'll on Netflix, they'll drop the whole season, and you can watch all 12 shows or whatever. But not only did they reduce the number of episodes of Swamp Thing, they're eking them out one at a time. And after they eked out the first one, they immediately canceled it, which to me doesn't make any sense. At the very least, see if you can gather an audience for it. It just befuddles me and a lot of other people as to why you would release a one episode and then cancel it. At least see if you get, generate an audience. So that's kind of weird. That shows a little bit more of a concern with what's going on and trying to figure out what's happening at DC and Warner in general. The next piece of news I want to hit, it's not really news. It's this weekend, of course, on June 8th in particular, is National Best Friends Day. And in honor of Toy Story 4, I was sent a little package that I was able to put together. And it's basically, it's probably one of the coolest action figures of self-assembly I've ever had to face. I can make my own Forky, which is, of course, the Spork character from the new Toy Story movie. So it's essentially, it's a do-it-yourself kit, and it has the spork and the pipe cleaners, and it basically is a kit of stuff that you could probably find on the ground outside of a Hobby Lobby or a Michael's Craft Store. But it's, you put it together and you can get this little spork character, Forky, from Toy Story 4. It's really cute. I got pictures of me putting it together on Best Friends Day with my kids. So you have to check my Twitter and Facebook for that, because you can go get these materials yourself for probably about 48 cents and make it yourself. So I will bring my expensive collectible action figure with me when I go see Toy Story 4 at the press screening, and I will be the envy of millions. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. I want to look at the new trailer for Rambo Last Blood, which opens on September 20th.
All these years I've kept my secrets. But the time has come to face my past. And if it comes looking for me, they will welcome death. I want them to know that death is coming.
I've liked the Rambo movies. Obviously, Sylvester Stallone's best characters, most endearing characters, are Rocky Balboa and John Rambo. And even though I think these divert differently from the original story, I mean, First Blood is a really good movie. I mean, First Blood is not just a violent explosion fest. I mean, Rambo, First Blood Part 2, and even Rambo 3, those movies are a cavalcade of violence and 80s action. But First Blood is actually deals with PTSD and the trauma that vets were going through when they came back from the Vietnam War. I mean, it has some legitimate issues in it. And that is what makes it such a great movie. Now, this one, he plays John Rambo again, going down to Mexico to save a girl who's been kidnapped. His character doesn't look as much like John Rambo because he's not, doesn't have the long hair, and he's not wearing camo, and he's not wearing the bandana. So it does sort of look like it could be him from Copland, maybe going to a different city. But I'm looking forward to it because I've enjoyed the Rambo movies. I particularly liked the Rambo that they did. Gosh, it must have been almost 10 years ago. I thought that was really a good John Rambo movie too. So I'm looking forward to it. Although it does kind of feel a little, the trailer makes it feel a little bit of like it might be a direct-to-video thing, but I'm still have faith. I'm going to go check it out. The next one I want to talk about is Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, which opens on August 9th.
What's that?
It's a book of scary stories.
Hey, what's going on?
Tommy's missing.
Tommy's name was in the book. There's no way it's actually connected, right? Okay, what if what happens in the book is exactly what's happened for real? Oh, my God. Listen, you're in the next story.
We're reading it right here.
I'm afraid that we woke something up.
You shouldn't have taken the book.
We've got to stop it.
I know I played a real teaser trailer for this after the Super Bowl when they dropped the trailers for that during the Super Bowl. I am playing this now because I think it's important to look at this movie. Looks actually really fantastic. You get a sense of the actual story, you get a sense of what the movie's about, and not just shots of old scary stories to tell in the dark tropes that we had read when we were younger. But it has this wraparound story of them finding a book. It's basically like if you could take the general gist of what they did with the Goosebumps movies and make it really dark and serious. And that's what you got, where they find this book that kind of brings them into it. It looks like it's an authentically scary movie. That's got to be Guillermo del Toro's work in this. It's sort of like the movie Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, almost 10 years ago. That one was an effective, scary movie that was lost on a younger generation, that sort of the millennials didn't quite get it, but the older generation thought it was fantastic. It actually got an R rating for being scary, and it looks like this Scary Stories that you can tell in the dark is about the same level of artistry for it. So I'm really looking forward to that one. That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Secret Life of Pets 2 and The Souvenir.
Thank you.
back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews, first of all, with one that I think is going to be the biggest of the weekend. I think this is going to win the weekend. And it should be able to knock off Godzilla, but I don't think it's going to do the 100 million that the original movie did. The Secret Life of Pets 2. After their owner gets married and has a kid, Max and Duke go on a farm vacation while Snowball the Rabbit tries to rescue a white Siberian tiger from a circus.
The baby is leaving the nest.
No, he's staying home with me, where it's safe.
Hey, Max. Liam just left.
Wait, what? This is home base to all units. The package has left the building. Does anyone have eyes on him?
I don't see him.
Woo-hoo! Attention, this is Captain Snowball.
We need backup.
Buckle up, everyone.
The first step of not being afraid is acting like you're not afraid.
When The Secret Life of Pets came out 3 years ago, it was kind of a surprise hit. It was the kind of movie that I don't think any, I mean, people knew it was going to do well because it's an animated film. It's from Illumination, which does the Minion movies. So it had a good pedigree, no pun intended, but I don't think anyone was expecting it to do as well as it did. I remember when the box office numbers rolled in, people were like, wow, this is a massive hit. And it makes sense. I mean, it's a summertime movie, animated. It's got dogs and cats. It's got all the pet humor. It's got kid humor. It's got all the jokes you'd get from a dog, you know, dogs sniffing each other's butts and all that kind of stuff. So you get all those jokes in there, but it's all kind of in a safe space because it's about dogs and pets, and it did phenomenally well, and it was a fun enough movie. It's not my favorite animated movie, but oh well. Well, of course, they had to do a sequel, and they couldn't do it with Louis C.K. because, well, you know what dogs do to people's legs, and they'd be afraid he'd be doing that. So they got rid of him, can't do a kid's movie with Louis C.K., and they brought in Patton Oswalt to do his voice. Don't make a point of it. They just try and sneak it in there. When you have a movie that has a big cast or a big group of characters. You saw this with the Ice Age movies, and you certainly saw it with the Madagascar movies, where the first movie worked. It clicked, everybody had a part, and there was no extraneous characters because the story was written for the characters that were in the story. There was no need to include anyone else because you wrote the story as it needed to be. Well, when they made the sequel to Madagascar, and when they made the sequel to Ice Age, and now when they made the sequel to Secret Lives of Pets, they have to find a place for everybody. All those characters from that first movie have to come back, or it's breaking down the theory. You're going to get rid of somebody's favorite character. So they got to have not just stuff for Max and Duke. You got to have stuff for Gidget. You got to have stuff for the Papa, the old Basset Hound. You got to have something for Snowball. You got to have something. Everybody's got to do something. And then on top of it, you've got to introduce new characters. So you actually have more characters in this movie, and it clutters it up because not everybody really has a good part. So they have to kind of fracture this into like three different stories, and it is a little bit disjointed. It feels more like a vignette. It feels more like they were going somewhere else. And you've seen this in other things. Guardians of the Galaxy did that. When they did the sequel, they had to split everybody up and have them go do their own thing in their own separate ways. I don't think it's finessed very well in The Secret Life of Pets 2. I think that they just kind of cram it in there, and they got what worked in time for them to start animating this movie. So the story's not really good. It's corny. It feels like a direct-to-video story. It feels like a, you know, TV series story. And part of that's because each of the stories only gets about 20 minutes of screen time before they all kind of have to mesh together at the end. But with that said, I mean, it's a kid's movie. It's about dogs and cats, and it's cute, and you got jokes, and, you know, it's family-friendly, it's animated, it's brightly colored, although the color palette sometimes is a little too pastel. So generally, the vibrancy of movies on the big screen, they diversify the colors, and the reds are darker and deeper, and the blues are darker and deeper. And then when they go to TV movie stuff, they don't do as vibrant stuff. When they do, like, direct-to-video stuff, and you saw that especially in the early 2000s, when they were doing animated sequels to like The Little Mermaid and that sort of thing, the colors palettes go a little more pastel and muted. I don't know why, but they do that. And I felt that the animation wasn't as crisp in this one as the original from 3 years ago. But like I said, it's an easy sell for kids. It's just not as transcendent to reach the adults as, you know, like something else, or even just the first movie was. I'm going to be nice. I'm going to say it kind of rocks, but that's just because I'm trying to look at it from the kids' points of view.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Souvenir. An aspiring filmmaker starts an awkward relationship with an older man, much to the confusion of her family and friends.
Do you think she suspects that you creeped down to our bed?
No. I thought we'd put Anthony down the end. It's not that kind of relationship anyway, is it?
If she does, that was an amazing performance. A very special journey.
No, I don't think I am.
Oh, no, you don't think you are.
Very normal, really.
You're not normal at all.
I feel as though I want to not live my whole life in this very privileged part of the world I come from.
Okay, this is one of those movies that confuses me more than anything. I'm more confused than the characters in this movie are confused about this relationship that these two people have. The publicist for this was trying to set up the screening because it apparently won a grand jury prize at Sundance, which supposedly means it's a really quality movie that everyone's going to want to check out. So I was like, okay, well, let's set it up this night and I'll make sure to go see it. And I had taken a nap earlier that day. Now, I've got a lot of stuff going on in my personal life that is kind of drawing some of my energy. So I tend to get tired very easily because I don't get as much sleep as I had been. But I made a point to take a nap this day. So I made a point. I was rested. I went to this movie and I started watching it. And I wish I hadn't taken a nap because I wish I could have fallen asleep in it. It is the most boring movie I have seen certainly this year. Possibly this decade. I'm not going to say this century because that might be a little overreaching, but it is so boring. When I left, there's always the publicist standing outside saying, hey, what'd you think? Can I give a quote back to the studio? And I'm always, I try to be a positive person. I even if I don't like it, I'd be like, I didn't like it. But, you know, like when I left Secret Life of Pets, I'm like, I wasn't a big fan, but kids are going to like it. You know, I always try to throw in something that to shows that I, at least I'm not looking at something in absolutes. I'm like, well, you know, some people might like it. Some people won't. It may not be my cup of tea, but I couldn't even for this one. I just said, I hated it. I absolutely hated it. I said it was like watching paint dry, but not even like if you're watching paint dry, at least there's like colors involved. While it's boring to watch it dry and I'm getting high on the fumes, at least there's color, but it's like watching multiple shades of beige dry. That takes twice as long as normal paint would. That is what it was like sitting through this movie. It was awful. It was so tough to just exist during. Well, and what's funny is it's like 2 hours. So I struggled to just make it through the movie. And then finally at about an hour, 20 minutes, I dozed off. This movie was so boring. It forced me to take a nap. It went into the back of my brain and squeezed on my spinal cord and put me to sleep, even though I had made a point to take a nap and get fully rested to go see this so I wouldn't fall asleep. That is the power of cinema right there. So yeah, the only use for this one is if you're having trouble sleeping or if you're frustrated with how pathetic your own life is, you can go watch this one to see how pathetic somebody else can be. The Souvenir sucks. I don't care. Grand jury prize or not. It sucks.
It sucks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Dark Phoenix and All Is True.
Stop it now.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews with the new films. The first one I want to talk about in this segment is Dark Phoenix. In this redo of the classic X-Men comic story arc, the tale of Jean Grey and her overwhelming powers is told on the big screen.
You're special, Jean. And if you stop fighting that force inside you, if you embrace it, you will possess the very power of a god.
Tell me how we fix this, Charles. Tell me what to do.
I don't know what to do.
This is your fault, Charles.
I tried to protect her.
I'm scared. When I lose control, bad things happen.
First of all, this is the last X-Men movie from this run that started in 2000. So we've had almost 20 years of these X-Men movies. I think it's like, what, 12 movies? That's also including the Wolverine standalone films and Logan. But this all kind of exists in this same universe where these are the only superheroes that exist. The reason it's the end of this is because Disney purchased the television and movie elements of Fox. So now Disney owns all this, and there's going to be some time for them to reconcile all of it, and they still have to finish the stuff that's in the pipeline, and, you know, there's been other movies that have come out. And but one of the reasons that Disney wanted Fox was they wanted to get control of the characters that Fox had licensed, mainly the X-Men and the Fantastic Four. I'm sure there's other ancillary stuff in there, like Daredevil, that they could eventually weave into their cinematic stuff. But that's what they were aiming for. And now you're going to start seeing the characters move into the Marvel Avengers universe. They're going to start being able to use the term mutant. They can start bringing a recasting Wolverine with Danny DeVito so he can finally fight the Hulk and all that kind of stuff. Now, this ends that series because they're going to redo all this and weave it into this series at Disney and possibly peppering some stuff into a Spider-Man movie if rumors are true. Now, the Dark Phoenix storyline was done once before in X-Men The Last Stand. It wasn't done well. I've never read the original comic series of the Dark Phoenix, so I don't have any skin in the game when it comes to if the original story was done properly. But I do know that there are a lot of fans that were upset with Brett Ratner's version of it, even though I kind of liked The Last Stand. I'm not coming from the source material. So let this, first of all, be a lesson to anybody. If you think it's pointless to do online petitions and complain and demand things done differently with your fan material, here's a great example of a studio saying, okay, we heard you. We're going to redo this. We're going to remake the Dark Phoenix as its own story specifically and not give it to a megalomaniacal director who is sexually assaulting women while he's doing it. So that's why they cut out Brett Ratner from that equation. With that said, this movie's got like a 20-some percent at Rotten Tomatoes. The critics aren't really happy with it. And from what I've heard from other people who've seen it, especially when I went and saw it, and I heard the scuttlebutt in the audience, it's a real mixed reaction. I don't know how good the adaptation is because I've never read the source material, but this isn't perfect from what I understand. This also uses the younger cast that started out in X-Men First Class and then moved on into Days of Future Past, where they kind of merged both casts. But this one has the younger generation. It's got Jennifer Gardner as Mystique. It's got Michael Fassbender as Magneto. It's got James McAvoy as Charles Xavier. It doesn't have the older folks involved in it. So it really kind of was a chance to redo it. Now, with all that said, and the history behind it, I thought it was fine. I didn't think it was as good as Days of Future Past or X-Men First Class. Weirdly enough, as much as everyone hates Bryan Singer now, really, let's be honest, the best X-Men movies have had him in control of them. He's really been the only ones who's delivered really, really good, solid. I mean, X-Men First Class was good, but he also came in directly as a producer on that one. And that's just the way it is. I mean, you can not like his behavior and you can be dubious of his potential criminal behavior, but the guy knows how to make X-Men movies. This one does not have Singer's hand in it, and I think it shows. X-Men Apocalypse, which was the last X-Men movie, which was kind of lame, and I think a lot of people kind of forget that even existed. So it feels much more like X-Men Apocalypse than it does feel like the classic first two X-Men movies, or even the 1-2 punch of First Class and Days of Future Past. But with that said, you know, when it comes to the spectacle and the effects and the fighting scenes, that they're all cool. And, you know, it's a standard X-Men movie. My biggest problem with it isn't even the action or the direction. I think the characters aren't very well developed in this. But I'm not a big fan of the actors in a lot of the roles. Sophie Turner as Jean Grey, I think she's kind of flat. And that's not a problem with her as an actor. I think she's fine elsewhere. It's just I never felt that she had much to offer in the character of Jean Grey. But like the new girl who plays Storms, she does a good South African accent, but that's about it. I think Halle Berry had more presence as a character than she did. And the guy who plays Cyclops is kind of, you know, I mean, it's just, there's some real sort of middling things that happen in this movie. And the other problem is they have this villain played by Jessica Chastain. And look, I've gone on the record before. I don't like Jessica Chastain as an actor. I'm that one guy who doesn't. But even what she's given, there's not a whole lot to it. The villain that she plays and the bad guys in this are very one dimensional and they're really corny. I mean, like early 2000s, like 1990 era superhero movie corny. And that's where it feels like it's existing, still trying to exist in that pre-2008 superhero world. So ultimately, I'm going to say Dark Phoenix is enjoyable, but it's not great. I'm ready to see this sort of get new life brought into it. If anything, this certainly says, all right, let's kill this franchise as it is and bring it into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But I'm going to have to be kind and say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Running out of time, but I want to really quickly go through All Is True. After his Globe Theater catches fire, William Shakespeare leaves London to reunite with his family in the country.
Father,
why are you coming? No more stories left to write.
I've lived so long in imaginary worlds, I think I've lost sight of what is real.
Your talent has a greater scope than all the other poets, and yet you lived the smallest life.
Family is everything.
You went to London and became this great writer. With a wife at home, you were hardly here.
To us, you're a guest. Good night, husband.
Retirement hasn't exactly brought the peace we might have hoped for.
Kenneth Branagh directs this. And of course, anyone who knows who Kenneth Branagh is and has seen his movies knows he's a huge Shakespeare fan. He's always directing movies about Shakespeare, or he's doing performances of Shakespeare. I remember I saw they performed one of the plays at the theater and they did a live broadcast of it. So he does this stuff all the time. He's heavily involved in it. So he's a big Shakespeare fan and it's appropriate for him to do this. And he's a pretty good director. He plays Shakespeare in this, which is, he's a little too Kenneth Branagh-y to actually be Shakespeare, but you know, no one ever accused him of having a small ego, but it's a pretty good cast. I mean, he does fine in the role, but you've got a lot of help from Judi Dench, who's cast a little young. I mean, she's supposed to be a woman in her late 50s, I think, in when this movie takes place, but she's like 86, I think. She's old. And you've got Ian McKellen in it. It's got a great cast. It's also got some beautiful cinematography. There are scenes where they light entirely with candlelight, which is very difficult to do with regular film, but you can do that with modern digital cameras now. So it's a beautiful looking movie and it's a well-constructed movie. But you got to realize, kind of like how Tolkien, the movie, was not about dwarves and hobbits and elves. Tolkien was about an academic who created them. This is not about Romeo and Juliet and Julius Caesar and Richard III or Othello or King Lear. This is about the guy who wrote about them. So it's essentially an interpersonal drama about a guy reconciling his life and his ups and downs and his regrets at the end of his life. Well made, although it does take some time to watch, and it's not exactly as exciting or as thrilling. It's more of a ease out of Shakespeare's life type of a movie than it is getting into the nitty gritty. Still, I'll be kind again and going to say All Is True kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
And that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the box office and the home cinema roundup featuring Captain Marvel and The Entity. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the box office really quick from last week. And Godzilla, King of the Monsters, did win the box office with just under $48 million. That's actually not bad. It's a low end of the box office opening weekend. Godzilla from 2014, I believe it had a huge opening weekend, but dropped off fast as a result of the fact that there wasn't much Godzilla in the movie at all. The fact that Godzilla King of the Monsters didn't even crack $50 million, I don't think necessarily is a bad thing, because first of all, I think this is going to do extremely well overseas. Mainly because kaiju movies are overseas properties. And as you saw with the Pacific Rim movies, those films were made for a global audience, not just America. So this is going to be a great example of, I mean, it's not going to be at the level of, say, something like Warcraft, which flopped completely, belly flopped in America, but made enough money in China alone to greenlight a sequel that's really only going to come out overseas. Godzilla King of the Monsters is a movie that I think will have pretty decent legs. I think it's going to have a slow drop off, and I think it's going to do extremely well overseas. It just barely beat out Aladdin. Aladdin had just under $43 million, which actually is a really good hold. As much as I'll malign Will Smith for things, and as much as I was not a huge fan of this new Aladdin, it has a better hold than I was expecting it to. It certainly has a better hold than, say, Solo, which I've been comparing it to. And that's okay. You know, well, that movie's doing well and Disney's making money off of it. Rocket Man did pretty decent with $26 million. And then Ma, actually, $18 million. That's really, really good off a $5 million budget. Good for Octavia Spencer. That's a really good opening weekend for a movie at the level of production and release that Ma got. So, good for them. Avengers Endgame is still out there kicking around in the theaters. It's got over 800 million. The thing is, I think they're just going to hold this in the theaters because right now, as I'm talking to you right now, Avengers Endgame is just about $65 million away from breaking Avatar's worldwide record, which in those numbers actually means that it already broke its initial release numbers. But it's only about 65 million away from breaking its worldwide record. And I think Disney's just going to leave it in the theaters just longer. They may reduce it and then have a big bump back, and they'll probably re-release it in theaters like beginning of September just to get a little bit of goose to the box office so they can get past that hump, because they're so close to beating Avatar as the number one movie of all time. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. These movies are not coming out this week, although they are available. Certainly Captain Marvel is available on demand right now. I want to talk about the Blu-ray a little early here because, you know, it's on demand. If you want to rewatch it, you can get all the special features on demand, or you can pick up the Blu-ray in just a couple days on Tuesday, either at a local retailer or online. But let's talk about Captain Marvel. Let's revisit that. This origin story follows an alien warrior who lands on Earth in the mid-90s only to discover her forgotten connection to the planet.
Your life began the day it nearly ended. We found you. With no memory, we made you one of us. So you could live longer, stronger, superior.
Something in my past is the key to all of this.
Would you like to know what you really are?
This is the first time I've seen Captain Marvel since its initial release, so I wasn't knowing what to expect when I first saw Captain Marvel, and it's nice to revisit it. I have a friend who was telling me he was not a big fan of this movie because he didn't feel that she had emotional depth to her, that she just sort of sat there and was very flatly dealing with things. And in a lot of ways, she's kind of cocky. But you know what? I'm watching it and I go, well, she's a fighter pilot. And then she goes on to be an elite warrior. She's going to be cocky. I mean, I don't know if it's real. I don't know any fighter pilots myself, but certainly the stereotype in movies and action movies and even science fiction movies is fighter pilots are cocky. They know what they're doing all the time. They're not easily shaken. And I know some people didn't like the coldness of Brie Larson's delivery, but I actually think it works. In specifically thinking about it this time around, there is a moment in there where she does have to reconcile some of the things that have happened to her. But I think she weathers that really well because the whole point is she keeps a lot inside and she deals with it inside and occasionally vents it out here and there when she's a little more vulnerable. But this is not a movie about a vulnerable character. She doesn't have to be laid bare, so to speak. And in fact, physically at times she is. Like, there's a scene where she's kidnapped by the Skrulls and they like hang her upside down and she gets herself out and she's barefoot because her feet were stuck in there and her hands are bound because, you know, she has that photon blast that she can do. So she's running around barefoot and technically disarmed is about as bare as you can get in a, well, in a family movie, but also metaphorically like that. And then she has to go get her boots so she can kind of dress in her uniform. I enjoyed this one even more the second time I saw it because I like the fact that we're going into some really out there characters. You know, this isn't as out there as Guardians of the Galaxy, but it's pretty out there with this alien that can shoot photons out of her hands. I think that's awesome. I think it's kind of cool delving into that category. And I'm looking forward to seeing more of what Marvel has to offer from some of their other lesser known characters that are more than just a guy who was bitten by a radioactive spider or a big green rage monster or something like that. I think it's neat to do some of these more outlandish, bizarre, sci-fi level superheroes. And also on the Blu-ray, there's a decent amount of special features. There's like deleted scenes, gag reel, and a bunch of behind the scenes stuff with an audio commentary. So it's definitely worth checking out and worth picking up for the disc just because you, nowadays it's going to be restricted to being able to stream this stuff on just the Disney service. So I'm going to have to say Captain Marvel, the Blu-ray totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue talking about some Blu-ray releases. The Entity Collector's Edition is being released by Shout Factory or Scream Factory, as it's better known. If you think of the book was written in the 70s or early 80s, and then it was made into a movie. The movie eventually came out in 83. I think it was done in production in 81. It's based on a true story of a woman in the 70s who would report that she was being sexually attacked by poltergeists. And this one stars Barbara Hershey as a woman who is a single mom raising three kids, and she is repeatedly sexually attacked by these poltergeists.
20th Century Fox presents the story of Carla Moran. The most extraordinary case in the history of psychic research.
Everything broke loose. It went crazy. And everything was shaking. The bed was shaking and the walls were shaking. And
like an earthquake.
No, it wasn't like an earthquake. It was much stronger than any earthquake. Oh, wait a minute. Honey, I don't really understand this. You were attacked?
Come here, come here.
Or you weren't? It happened. I don't know. There was no one there.
I'd seen this movie before in college on television, so I didn't get the full effect because the attack scenes are as graphic as you're going to get from mainstream movies from the early 80s, but they're pretty intense. And there's multiple scenes of this. And I think a lot of that got cut out on the TV viewing, so it was a little bit hard to follow. The other thing I found fascinating about this movie is Ron Silver plays the doctor who's trying to help her out. And it's very much steeped in 80s, early 80s, late 70s machismo sexism that masquerades as understanding and progressive, but really it's still this doctor trying to mansplain to her what's happening to her, even though her experience is not consistent with what he says her experience is. So it is interesting to look at how much of a jerk the Ron Silver character is, even though he's supposed to be at the time, whereas the bad guy's the head of the hospital who say, no, she's just hysterical. And it's a neat movie. It is. And it's a bold choice to have a poltergeist sexual attack in the first 10 minutes of a movie. That's kind of jarring if you don't know what you're getting into with this one. So it's allegedly based on a true story. Now, on the special features, they have some new interviews with Barbara Hershey and another one of the actors and the composer and the editor. There's also new audio commentary on it. The best special feature is one, it's a vintage one that's kind of pulled from, I think, the DVD. It's called The Entity Files, which is an interview with parapsychologist Barry Taft, who was involved with the original case. And he goes through what the reports were for that and sort of some of their methodology and shows some of the evidence. And that's kind of an interesting element as well. So I got to say, for this one, Scream Factory is putting out some fantastic Blu-rays of old horror films. And this is one of those. So if you want something that's like late 70s, early 80s supernatural thriller, this is a good one. So I'm going to have to say this totally rocks as well.
It rocks.
Excellent.
Other releases this week include A Madea Family Funeral, The Man Who Killed Don Quixote, Jack Ryan Season 1, Lost in Space Season 1, and The Flash Season 5. That is it. Next week I'm going to be coming back to talk about Men in Black International, Shaft, The Dead Don't Die, and Late Night. And that's it. I need to go. Have a great weekend, everybody. And until we meet again, have a fat time at the movies.